Thanks very much indeed, Peter, for that over-generous introduction. It's indeed an enormous pleasure to be here because David Nicholls was a great friend. And I knew him, as Peter has indicated, in really the early days of the Jubilee Group, along with Ken Leach and the then young Rowan Williams. And Jubilee was a group in the Anglo-Catholic socialist tradition, therefore a bunch of mavericks. But even within a bunch of mavericks, David Nicholls was a maverick, because I think he would not quite have owned to the name socialism at all. Where I remember him always saying, I'm not an authoritarian like socialists are. I'm some kind of Christian anarchist. And I think in those days, when I debated with David, he was also part of the Christendom Trust. So part of that sort of very non-William Temple strand in Anglican social thinking, the less statist strand that derives more from John Nevile Figgis, the Merfield monk, more interested in the spontaneously social than anything state-directed. And I would say that to some degree, David felt that I was not distrustful enough of the state. And in many ways, I would say that I'm now probably closer to David Nicholls' positions than I was when he was alive. It's horrific to realize that I'm slightly older than he was when he tragically died. That's just a dreadful realization. But at the time, David would say to me, you know, there are no solutions to capitalism through the state in the end. The absolutely sovereign state and capitalism are really two halves of the same picture. And he took far more seriously than I did ideas about the social market, ideas that you need to infuse the economy itself with social responsibility. So really what follows is an act of repentance on my part. I'm not quite sure that it fulfills the very long title that I gave ages ago, although it works round to those issues in the end, because I think in many ways we live in an era of the crisis of the nation state, an era where identity is enormously problematic, where pluralism is at once the name of a problem and the possible name of a solution. And this, again, makes David Nicholls extraordinarily prophetic. But as I say, what follows is kind of an act of repentance, because in a way, this is an articulation of our need now to craft something like a social market. And the short title of this paper is Justice and Process, Our Economic Legacy, with the word economic in inverted commas. So here we go. A question repeatedly asked today concerns the invasion of all aspects of our social and political life by the amoral logic and practice of the modern market. To what extent can markets and so-called privatization be held at bay? Of course, this is a valid question. There is something inherently dangerous about money, intrinsically contaminating about the impersonality of commercial exchange. To some degree, the economy is a kind of feral monster that you need to keep at bay from wider society, from health, education, sport, the arts, and political practice. Nonetheless, I do think that there is another question to be asked. This is occasioned by the reflection as to how far is the market a monster that can plausibly be held at bay or even partially tamed, given that it tends to be all ravening. If that reflection leads us to pessimistic despair, then maybe this despair can only be overcome by entertaining a far bolder optimistic hope, which would be enshrined in another question. This other question is very simply, how can you have moral markets? Can the monster be not just retrained or semi-tamed, but altogether domesticated? And would such domestication, in fact, better fulfill the very logic of market exchange itself, which, it can be argued, is not really a kind of abstractly released pure ferality, animality in a city suit, so to speak, but rather a natural part of human culture, embedded in naturally cultural practices of reciprocity and mutually beneficial closure around the human circle. I want to approach this question, first of all, genealogically, by asking it the other way around. And the other way in which I hope this lecture is in a Nichols tradition is engaging in questions of theological paradigms for our notions of both political and economic power. Why have we got the idea that somehow the economy and morality are naturally averse to each other? For in terms of the whole gamut of human history, this looks like an extremely peculiar view. Here I think it's useful to start by distinguishing between the marketplace on the one hand and the market on the other. By marketplace, I mean any kind of process of exchange, which, as the postfix place might suggest, is typically in terms of quite stable ethical values and firmly fixed understandings of people's place in the social order, in the social hierarchy, however relatively egalitarian that might be, and what people can reasonably expect within those roles. We should distinguish marketplace exchanges in this sense, on the one hand, which are linked indeed often to a specific physical site, like a literal marketplace. We should distinguish those sorts of marketplace exchanges from market exchanges in the modern capitalist sense, where what we mean by a market is that it undergoes clearance in terms of the matching of supply with demand. This second sense of market is unusual. It has characterized the West increasingly only since the 18th century, and therefore there is no reason to see it as something given and natural. We rather have to regard it as, in Karl Polanyi's terms, something that is both socially embedded and politically instituted. Polanyi rightly said that today we perversely think that the society is embedded in the economy rather than the other way round. However, he also indicated that this is something of an illusion even for our modern capitalist situation. Thus, he additionally claims that even a capitalist economy is in fact embedded in a certain anthropology, a certain notion of the human being, a certain sense and practice of society, and a certain sense of what the business of political legislation ought to be. If the modern market, rather than traditional marketplace, remains in this various way socially embedded, then one could equally say that it has been politically instituted. Just because somehow the supply and demand mechanism seems to work automatically, we have the illusion that this is a natural mechanism and not actually embedded in a set of political preferences that privilege aggregate economic growth over a wider definition of human flourishing, and a set of legislative measures that render ownership and contract absolute and separate from custom, inheritance, and duty, while progressively distinguishing an absolutely reserved private sphere of landed reward and income from licensed corporate responsibility. In these ways, then, the modern market is not natural, but politically instituted. And its reverse embedding of the social in itself conceals its continued embedding in a certain revised social conception that tries rather bizarrely to distill social consensus from canonized individual autonomy. If anything, it would seem that it is the traditional marketplace that is natural, since it has nearly always prevailed. However, the marketplace is also, and more directly, socially embedded and always upheld in some sense by political legal order, even if for tribal societies this is sometimes entirely distributed and unconsciously exercised through a rigid set of ritual practices. So if the marketplace is natural, this is only in the somewhat mysterious sense that most human beings, for most of their history, seem, as it were, naturally to have elected for the same basic underlying cultural option. But what then are the big decisive economic differences between the market and the marketplace? First of all, as Polanyi and many others have stressed, some things in the marketplace were sacred. Some things could not be exchanged. Some things could not even enter into processes of gift exchange. In particular, as Polanyi emphasized, people, land, and money itself were regarded as things which should not be exchanged or speculated upon. People and land because they were sacred. Money for the exactly reverse reason, that it's a totally desacralized mere mediation medium of exchange and therefore should not be fetishized, idolized, or sacralized. We can usefully ask ourselves how far today we still respect these sacralities and the non-sacrality of money in a highly secularized world. To some extent, we must still do so in a pain of loss of our humanity altogether. Even today, we do not readily treat people as commodities or see all space as equal in value. People live in homes which they regard as inviolable. Many buildings and terrains are protected as being of special significance, like the heart of Oxford. And even the craziest financial speculator just about loves his Ferrari and his underfloor swimming pool a little more than he does his investment portfolio. Yet, incrementally, terrain gets further and further quantified and treated at once as a sheer geometric magnitude and as an arithmetic multitude that can be parceled up, reconfigured, and assigned a primarily abstract value. Equally, people trafficking is on the rise in both criminal and more disguised legal idioms. The capitalist reduction of people's labor power or their bodies to commodity status now extends also to their minds and their leisure time. Meanwhile, both state and market conspire to remove human procreation from the risky and messy sphere of interpersonal heterosexual relationships and subject it to both market exchange and bureaucratic management. But beyond this point, in the case of the traditional marketplace, we can also say that where things were exchanged, they were mainly exchanged in terms of reciprocal benefit, however hierarchically this was often construed, and respect for preceding social roles, as in the case of Aristotle's account of proper commercial practice. It follows that things that were exchanged in the marketplace were not commodities in Karl Marx's sense. Exchange constantly took place, but did not automatically involve the subordination of use value to exchange value. This was because it did not break with, but rather sustained, a socially constitutive process of mutual recognition, a mutual acknowledgement of respective honor, trade, and educational or formative requirements. For this reason, one could say that in most societies, for most of human history, people have been hobbits. They simply want respectability within the shire, which may involve much despicable petty backbiting and rancour, but relatively little serious overweening ambition. But equally, all societies have known that there are always going to be some maniacs, incredibly dangerous people who would like to go off and work for Saruman, for example. Most societies have therefore supplemented processes of mutual recognition with mechanisms for warding off the dangers posed by the human jokers and wildcards, besides the threats from nature, other tribes, and empires. And so, perhaps the strangest thing about our modern society, as the anthropologist Mary Douglas and others have argued, is that we have not only abolished these mechanisms, but have even come to regard the egoistic social menace as the model exemplary citizen. As Robert and Edward Skidelsky have written, it would seem that our modern society, reversely embedded in the economy, has made a Faustian pact with the devil, relying on the technical balance of demonic forces rather than on intrinsic justice to deliver a kind of simulacrum of order. But what is most important is to undercut any sense of historical inevitability about this process. Here also we are bedeviled into thinking that technocratic bedevilment is simply fated through a sort of reversal of trust in the providential history. Therefore, we should today attend to the evidence of a lot of recent medieval and early modern historians who suggest that in the initial phase of the development of Western technology, the growth of an urban and a monetary economy was not necessarily going in a capitalist direction. To the contrary, right up to the time of early modernity, primordially derived processes of reciprocity and economic gift exchange were being reinforced through this urban economy and remained, to some degree, its real basis and the real basis for liftoff, especially in the Italian city-states, who were the initial motors of this takeoff, and yet whose bounded locality secured a certain recycling of wealth within the commune, and so a constant reconstitution of social exchange within which the marketplace remained embedded. One cannot then account for the emergence of capitalism simply in terms of industrial and communicative progress, or even in terms of the expansion of the monetary economy, or even in terms of the growth of capital. And here, both liberals and Marxists are often equally guilty of simply not historicizing enough and not seeing the sheer contingency of the eventual Western course of development. For it's certainly not the case that the West was the first to get to capitalism, as if everybody was bound to get there in the end. The issue is far rather, how on earth did the West come to bend urban, technological, and economic development in a specifically capitalist direction? Here I would argue that the Anglican and socialist historian R.H. Tawney, who was wickedly rubbished by second-rate minds like G.R. Elton, Hugh Trevor Roper, was, after all, essentially right. He's right back in fashion now, I'm glad to say. The process that led to contingently to capitalism has to do with religion, with Christianity and late medieval and early modern developments within Christian theology and practice. Tawney, who had not read Weber before he developed his own thesis about Protestantism and capitalism, though the issue is rather broader than that conjunction. Tawney rather than Weber, I would say, because the latter focused too narrowly on Puritan psychology, whereas the former focused on an entire reconstruction of theological anthropology and the doctrines of creation and salvation, with a matched alteration in ethical and political practice as the really decisive factor. In keeping with, but in considerable extension of Tawney's diagnosis, one can say that Protestant theology inherited and developed what I'd want to call metaphysically a disconnection of reality, a nominalist denial that all effects analogically echo their causes in a great chain of being leading back finally to God the Creator. In consequence, for this older analogical and participatory vision, we live in a naturally just cosmos where all eventually returns to its source and in due measure. That process is interrupted by sin, but even that is set right by grace. Crucially, subjects and objects belong within this single continuum, such that if objects also unconsciously praise their maker, or things rather than objects, subjects also have their natural place in a given cultural order, however variously construed, with legitimate variation according to different social paradigms. The cosmos is an organism suffused with life and mind in various degrees. It was not actually scientific and critical objectivity, but rather a misguided and priggish pietism, informed by a very poor reading of the Bible, which saw in all this traditional picture an excessive paganism, and wished rather to celebrate an entirely inscrutable, self-willed, and self-caused God, who has created the world as an arbitrary set of disconnected things, linked together then only either by impersonal mechanism or sheer willed imposition. Human beings operate on this mechanical natural order no longer in the first place with respect to justice towards all creatures, including human beings, but in the image of a self-willed God as mere dominators and manipulators of dead, meaningless processes. Furthermore, because for much Protestant thought, but also equally for distorted Catholic versions of Augustinianism, human beings are totally or nearly totally depraved after the fall, society cannot be governed at the most basic level by appeal to a lost sense of intrinsic justice. Instead, order must either be imposed by an absolute ruler, newly monopolizing sovereignty in the way that David Nichols criticized, or it must be distilled from the balancing of vice with vice. Inherent justice therefore vanishes in favor of technological procedures for coordinating and turning into profit or political power our very worst human instincts, the lowest common human denominators. This picture can be in various ways supplemented. First of all, as the late and great Catholic social theorist Ivan Illich liked to point out, the story of the Good Samaritan remains uniquely paradigmatic and significant. In Jesus' parable, we have a case of somebody exercising friendship totally outside national and cultural boundaries, and yet in terms of proximity. The Samaritan from afar comes near to be our neighbor. It's a very paradoxical parable. What that did, the example of this paradigm, was to set up a dynamic of free association in the West that retained intimacy and yet exploded across given borders. From the Christian outset, people founded monasteries, and later they formed friaries, guilds, universities, chivalric orders, hospices for the infirm and widowed, and many forms of lay association. This process was way in excess of anything similar that had occurred in the antique pagan city. The second socially relevant thing that is specific to Christianity, as has recently been discussed by the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben, and perhaps rather more accurately by the Jewish philosopher Dotan Leshem, whose book is soon to come out, is the extraordinary way in which Christianity extended the cash group, the oikos, or household, to the political sphere. The church thought of itself as an oikos, as a household, as an economic community, rather than as a polity, perhaps. But still more than this, the very divine providential government of the world was described by the Greek fathers as an oikonomia, and not really any longer so much as a politeia. An oikonomia implies that an overseer possesses a very detailed concern for everybody's very specific well-being, the kind of concern that a parent would have for their children. Michel Foucault's explanation of the rise of pastoral rule and of the biopolitical clearly occupies this space also, although Foucault, like Agamben in his wake, regards this phenomenon, I think, with far too much suspicion. What is most extraordinary about the Christian sense of oikonomia is that it begins with the sense that there is an abundance of divine grace that is infinitely and conveniently, to use the scholastic term, adapting itself to our finite needs. This is exactly the opposite of what we've eventually come to think of as the economic, where we have infinite needs but the resources are scarce, as I'm going in a moment to try to elaborate. This debased conception is precisely an inversion of the original meaning in theology of oikonomia. In this light, the contingent displacement of the marketplace by the market in the Christian West can be described as a kind of perversion of the Christian legacy. So the fact that we're dominated by the economic is something post-Christian, but it's nonetheless a twisting of Christian reality. Ivan Illich talked about the institutionalization of charity, the interplay with the neighbor who comes from afar, which has evolved either into bureaucracy on the one hand, or alternatively into contractual relations at a distance, in which dealings with a stranger become completely indifferent to any notion of charity altogether. So on the one hand, we have a smothering, a very strict, nanny-ish kind of bureaucracy. On the other hand, we get a totally indifferent, cold, big wide smile that means nothing, totally amoral market. In either case, mechanism has displaced the just pursuit of the common good. In the one case, by centralized, deliberate control over surveillance. In the other, indirectly, by an apparently automatic but equally mechanical and impersonal process. Now, today, in a quite extraordinary fashion, these two processes are often coalescing. Thus, in the United Kingdom and elsewhere, governments impose bureaucratic systems that enforce an internal market on universities, hospitals, and schools. Instead of seeking to collaborate, individuals are set at each other's throats, with the resulting anarchy then justifying an ever-increased culture of digital surveillance. Inevitably, the erstwhile truly professional worker within these systems comes to regard his employers and employment cynically, I certainly do, and seeks to manipulate and evade a series of extrinsic restrictions. I just delete all the emails, really. No longer increasingly do these institutions work through an inculcation of vocation or the expectation that the employee will have tacitly internalized the just goals which these institutions originally existed to pursue. But we really only arrive finally at the modern contemporary sense of the economic, Jean-Claude Mecaire and other French researchers have shown, through the influence of those Catholic Augustinian extremists known as the Jansenists. The Jansenists are finally far more responsible for capitalism than the Protestants were. They considered that lapsed human beings are almost as entirely depraved as did the Calvinists, so that it's impossible to produce a human society on the basis of morality. In consequence, they more explicitly promoted the idea, being French and more philosophically worked out than Protestants, that divine economic government works through our vices, distilling a serviceable, if not good or just order, out of the selfish or even the outright perverted. Despite my remark just now, this is characteristic also of some French Huguenot thought. It's no accident that Bernard de Mondeville was a Huguenot in exile in London. Thus one gets his famous nostrum, private vices, public benefits. In this manner, the model of the hidden hand that is transposed in more naturalistic terms by Adam Smith is crucially theological, as something that David Nichols also wrote about in one article. It is a theory about how divine government construed as an economizing works. What is really peculiar about this legacy, the legacy derived from this model, is that it provides, in one sense, an extremely hedonistic norm of social behavior. We're just dealing with people's material desires. Yet this very norm is also at bottom sustained by a certain gloomy kind of piety or theology. We're resigned to bad behavior rather than necessarily openly commending it, or some people do and others don't. Thus, the British Conservative Party is in consequence still to this day, to some degree, an alliance between a certain puritanical kind of mainly evangelical Christian and cynical city hedonists on the other hand. So we're still living out this strangely two-faced legacy. Yet despite this genealogy, it would not be true to say that political economy got totally amoralized until we get to the phenomenon of marginalist theory in the late 19th century. For all the appeal to morally neutral or even bad instincts in, say, Adam Smith or David Ricardo, the ultimate goals of policy retained with them some sort of humanly substantive character, national well-being, rural and urban flourishing, and so forth. The difference with marginalism is that it doesn't assume any objective teleology whatsoever. It is a rational choice theory, which primarily assumes merely that human beings are faced with all sorts of choices that they pursue according to a utilitarian calculus and a mechanical instrumentality. Its second assumption is one of scarcity, in a particular form and on a particular basis. Just as its utilitarianism implies a loss of belief in cosmic teleology, so likewise its assumption of scarcity implies a loss of belief in the superabundant God of creation, or in the plenitude of redeeming grace. However, it's essentially the loss of teleology that entails the rise of scarcity. This occurs because if there are no longer any intrinsically appropriate human ends, then it follows that our desires must be random. They must be both various and infinite, and in either case, amorally legitimate. But such anarchic desire has to put a strain even upon divine plenitude, which, although inexhaustible, always reaches us through time and place in a measured economic and ecological form. Here we face the benign paradox that if we treat nature as in limited supply in any given particular place and for any particular stretch of time, then we guarantee its real and eternal imminent inexhaustibility. The superabundant frontal provision of a living cosmic organism suffused by divine wisdom, the co-working of Lady Sophia that the Bible tells us about, are not the bounded dead mechanism of modern theological imagining, doomed in the end to wind down like a clock or to meet with eventual physical and Malthusian entropy. Thus we get the strange paradox that ecological damage is linked to an economic assumption of scarcity, not to an assumption of superabundance. If, as with marginalism, one assumes the anarchically infinite variety of proper desire, then this false infinity effectively denies the real imminent infinity and non-scarcity of nature, if treated in due measure and in observance of reasonable and truly desirable ends. It should be that it is our desire of temporal rather than eternal things that is limited, in contrast to nature's inexhaustible provision. But within the marginalist purview, this priority, by a further extension of reversed embedding, gets inverted. Now our finite desires for finite things are regarded as infinite, and equivalently, nature is fantasized as scarce. So instead of desire being seen as lying in connected continuity with natural essences and their graded modes of return to their true selves and so to God, which reaches a culmination in spiritual creatures, nature is inversely and perversely located within our desiring horizon. Then, by a final twist of irony, the fantasy of a scarce nature proves to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Since unleashed anarchic desire, failing to observe due measure, times and seasons, injustice to the surrounding natural world, indeed ensures that its real underlying metaphysical inexhaustibility is occluded by a man-made blight of truly now experienced ecological prevailing scarcity. The opposite of this, as the Skidelskis and the Labour MP John Cruddas have so cogently argued, has to be some kind of reinvocation of eudaimonia in the Aristotelian sense, some sense of objective human flourishing. In other words, if there is an objective scale of values, a shared sense of relatively worthwhile ends, however subject, as for Aristotle and Plato, to constant civic debate, one's not saying they're for all time evident, then there can be something more like temporary and emplaced sufficiency. For the really worthwhile goods, like marriage and children, good neighbours, and a fulfilling task that you have to perform, a lifetime vacation, enjoying the landscape where you live, these are obviously not so subject to the marginalist criteria. And finally, they're not subject to those criteria at all. For this reason, and because we can perhaps never quite surrender our humanity, which is linked to these permanent goods, these goods that are not in short supply, we can't do that without ceasing to live and breathe altogether. It may be that one problem with modern economics is that it misdescribes even what is going on nowadays. Perhaps even today, more of a marketplace alongside the market remains than we think, however much it's being ceaselessly displaced from the center of our lives. Have we ever been fully capitalist, one can ask, any more than we've ever been fully modern, to echo Bruno Latour? Surely not, just to the measure that we retain some sense, however minimal, of human decency. Thus, even today, as with the considerable growth of hybrid business-cum-charities that pursue also social purposes, and businesses clumping together under guaranteed charters of good practice, especially in northern and central Italy, people still naturally find ways to reinfuse the economy, both with a properly parentalist care and a gift-exchanging reciprocity. We have not entirely lost contact with the seemingly universal basis of all human society, nor with the specific Christian eruption of charity, which, as I've argued, first of all, bent society and politics in an economic direction, a turn that was in time grossly perverted. In this sense, there remains hope, not in revolution, nor in more centrally imposed reform that David Nicholls was so wary of, but rather in a diverse doing differently that requires a cultural transformation and perhaps a religious revival if it is to be aggregated to the point of general takeoff. But what today would be an alternative to the justice bracketing mechanisms of both market and bureaucracy really amount to? Any re-embedding of the economy and the polity in social reciprocity implies socialism, or the priority of the social in a generic sense, that may have rather little to do with what we've usually taken socialism to mean. I want, therefore, to conclude this lecture with an extremely brief account of the history of socialism in relation to economics. Socialism, it can be claimed, has, as a historical doctrine, basically exhibited three stages. To begin with, in the early 19th century, socialism was a profoundly anti-economic doctrine, precisely because it assumed that the economic was defined in the way that the political economists had defined it, as a distilling of order out of self-centered disorder. There was no socialist political economy. That would have been a contradiction in terms. Socialism conceived itself as an alternative to political economy. The early socialists tended, therefore, to see socialism and cooperation in production as alternatives to any kind of process of economic exchange, because they assumed that that involved amorality. Even Karl Marx, in a sense, is imagining a future in which exchange will have ceased. Exchange with nature or exchange with other human beings, and it will be a pure utopia of productivity and release of all of nature's productive powers. But after 1890, we witnessed the birth of a second kind of extremely novel economistic socialism, in which overwhelmingly the whole of the left, whether we're talking about Fabians in England, perhaps the people David Nicholls most of all loathed, or eventually the leaders behind the Iron Curtain, accept the precepts of marginalism, and so accept the logic of rational calculation and assumed but actually contrived scarcity. You can't understand China today unless you realize that from the very outset, the USSR was going in that direction. Thus, many researchers have pointed out that the invisible hand of the market or the visible hand of the state can both operate in terms of rational technocratic utility. Indeed, quite often when neoliberals like Friedrich Hayek were modeling the perfect market, they actually used the socialist state as an example to model what it would look like. Because in a sense, the state is like God, and it is God that stands behind the idea of the invisible hand. This is also why Mrs. Thatcher vastly increased the power of the central state in the course of extending the supposedly free market. Therefore, even when we get so-called market socialism, in the case of the former Yugoslavia, and within the idea of common property, sometimes even that notion was presented in terms of this will better realize a perfect Smithian free market in terms of goods other than labor if you leave labor as a fixed and pre-priced entity. The goal to how rational market clearance was still in place within this kind of socialism. The dominance on the political left since the 1990s, the 1890s, sorry, of socialism too, means that we have inherited, largely unquestioned, a dreadful failure on all sides of the political spectrum to challenge the idea that the economy and the market must necessarily be amoral regions. But there exists a big historical contrast in modern times to this assumption, as has been narrated by the renowned Italian economists Luigino Bruni and Stefano Zamani. They have argued that the Italian tradition of so-called civil economy, economia civile, never quite accepted the French and then Anglo-Saxon pietistically gloomy yet ultimately hedonistic way of looking at things. The crucial thinker here is Smith's immediate predecessor, Antonio Genovesi, who, when he was young, heard the great Giambattista Vico lecture in his native Naples. It's interesting that Genovesi is in Naples surrounded by a lot of primitive wildness, just as the Scots economists are in Edinburgh or Aberdeen or Glasgow, surrounded by a lot of primitive wildness. None of that is accidental. But the decisive point of contrast with Smith is that whereas the Scottish thinker insists strongly on the role of mutual sympathy in the social realm at large, he doesn't really allow sympathy inside the economic contract itself. Very simply and notoriously, for Smith, you and your butcher don't care about each other's welfare when you're making a transaction. This is the exact point of difference with the Italian civic economic tradition. That tradition thinks that because the butcher is also your neighbor upon whose skills you rely, just as he reciprocally relies upon your custom in order to keep going, you do actually care, and for conjoined ethical and realistic reasons. One can think today in a relatively trivial but illustrative way of shopping at your local butcher's rather than at your local supermarket, even though the latter is cheaper, in order to keep the local butcher, his livelihood, convenience, and better practice in existence. Of course, such an instance occurs today rarely, and usually among people in a privileged position to make that kind of exception. It doesn't occur sufficiently much to make an aggregative difference. But that's only because the market pressures are so massively stacked against it. It doesn't mean that if more socially aggregated, such an attitude and such a practice is impossible. The possibility rather remains that in a more locally collective mode, combinations that pursue economically better practice can eventually accrue even a market advantage, since they will be offering a manifestly more desirable service. The example of the history of John Lewis is endlessly trotted out, but it remains true for all that. This feasible prospect can be connected with my earlier point that we have never become quite as capitalist as we imagine. Even now, today in the UK, as in the rest of Europe, and frequently far more so on the continent, familial, neighbourly, local and regional transactions that can involve an economic element, but they are interwoven with each other. In manifestation of this connection, we have in this country the quite striking success of the Bristol Pound, where usage of a strictly local currency in this city region of the southwest of England has helped to keep wealth and resources within a certain area, and so both to recycle it and sustain it within what must ultimately be a circle of reciprocal benefit. But this kind of practice has been more consistently exemplified within the Italian tradition, where the city-state legacy of the Comune has combined with Aristotelian, humanist, and Catholic legacies to encourage also in practice Genovese's sense that the economic contract itself can be a site of social negotiation. For lovers of Italy, one quickly realizes that that is the plus side of the national political anarchy. and why to think of Italy only in those terms is incredibly misleading. In other words, on this assumption, within any economic engagement, you're not just going for what independently you want, but you're also trying to work out what would be fair between you and your neighbour and for the wider community. Such a model only appears unrealistic because we've so constructed our social codes as to make purely selfish economic behaviour seem something other than dishonourable, which it surely is in intrinsic terms. For human beings, first of all, seek social recognition, and they only pursue personal gain as a primary goal if thereby, as in the United States, of course, supremely, social recognition thereby accrues to you. Shame would quickly put a stop to such behavior. So what I want finally to recommend is a third socialism, which would be a civil economy socialism, in the hope that David in heaven is agreeing with me. If socialism is exactly the right word, and maybe it isn't, that would be a socialism that would see the economy as fully part of civil society and would try to redesign the economic contract itself. It would be a socialism less inimical to the co-priority with production of exchange. A socialism indeed still suspicious or outlawing of usury in line with Thomas Aquinas, but also accepting, like Aquinas, and unlike most classic socialisms, that returns on shares are legitimate if real risks have been undergone and real responsibilities mutually shouldered. This would be a new mode of modern market, a still marketplace, but not technically a mode of modified capitalism, because any system of contract dominated by ethical justice rather than a machinic coordination of egotisms could no longer be a system in which the accumulation of capital rather than the general pursuit of human flourishing is the dominating factor. And I would want to define capitalism rather simply and naively, I think, in those terms. Such a third socialism, economic like the second socialism, but ethical like the first one, would bring, in the wake of Karl Polanyi's trajectory, Mosean perspectives on gift exchange as socially constitutive into dialogue with Marx's reflections on production, and with Catholic social teaching's demand for a guiding architectonic justice in both the economic and the political spheres. I should say, the best of Anglican social teaching also. This returns us to the entire question of who can be the agents of such transformation in practice today and exactly how. I don't, of course, know of any full answer here. But I think that what the recent slogans of so-called post-liberalism in British politics, like Red Tory with Philip Blond, Blue Labour with Lord Glasman, the Big Society with David Cameron, pre-distribution and One Nation Labour with the Ed Miliband of a year ago, now sadly deceased, it seems. What these slogans are all groping towards is a new paradoxical fusion, very much in the traditions of Cobbett, Carlyle, and Ruskin, of a greater participatory democracy on the one hand, with some elements, let us admit it, of high Tory parentalism on the other. In other words, they suggest that we need to break with the paradigms of the past by combining in a paradoxical co-belonging a practice of honourable leadership and a more participatory democracy in order to supplement representational democracy, which is now just so corrupted by propaganda that it no longer allows any of us to make the real decisive choices through processes of formal election. These badly need supplementing or even eventually overridden, in my view. a simultaneous restoration of virtuous ethos to both elites and popular forces through a wholesale renewal of education that must largely, perhaps, be undertaken by faith movements. Combined with the social and political encouragement of ethical business, is surely needed if we are to re-embed the economic in the social and to restore ethics to the market. Therefore, we need to work at the level of cultural ethos and at the same time at the level of legislation, from below and above at the same time. We need a change in company law that would insist that every company pursue a social purpose. If you're making cars, for example, then you are making cars and not just making money. Even you may be making cars for the love of it, because as I say, we've never been as capitalist as we thought. You are making money, but you're also making cars, and they should be well crafted by fairly rewarded workers, as of course is more the case in Germany than elsewhere. We need vocational entry requirements for almost every profession and trade, and therefore some kind of restoration of a guild process as still just about exists in Germany. We need a sharing of risk and responsibilities between investors and owners, shareholders and managers, lenders and borrowers, and employers and employees. If we're going to have a market exchange, let us have genuinely fair market exchange and competition. We also need, besides the participation of workers in businesses, a certain backing up by courts of law on questions of fair price, wage, in mortgages, and interest on loans. They have to be able progressively to lay down certain boundaries. Now, all this may seem well nigh impossible in the current circumstances, and that may indeed lamentably prove to be the case. Yet, one can plausibly argue that an ethical economy would be a more stable and more viable economy for two reasons. First, a lot of firms, even ones like Walmart in the US, are discovering that if you're too uprooted, if you don't care about the communities in which your businesses are situated at all, in the long run, that has a negative business consequence. But the paradox of social benefit thinking is that you have to pursue it sincerely. And I think that's sometimes what its Harvard Business School advocates get wrong. It can't just be pursued for utilitarian reasons. If people do not really want to pursue social benefit as a direct aim, then they will cut corners. Nonetheless, if you sincerely pursue social benefit alongside economic benefit, if like the Quaker businessmen of the past, you really and truly want to do good, it will deliver a more stable long-term economic advantage. The big question then is, how can good economic practice drive out bad practice? Sometimes bad business practice is advantageous in terms of our current capitalist market. At other times, good practice delivers a clear, even short-term benefit by undercutting, sometimes this bad practice can deliver a clear short-term benefit by undercutting more scrupulous rivals. Yet in the long term, good practice is more stable even in current market terms, unless the racketeers so twist the entire economic stage